If you want to see examples of what we talked about on the show, check out bunchofdorks.com and click on the Cyclops.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Two Dimension Comics, the podcast with no direction. I'm your host, Dallas Busha, and today I've got Don and Al with me. And this is episode number 99, and we have a very special guest today, Mr. Anthony DeZiato. Hello, Anthony.
Hey, guys.
Hey, Anthony is a documentarian. I don't know, would that be the right term?
Sure.
I might have just made that up. He's the mastermind behind the documentary My Comic Shop documentary, which you can find on flatsquirrelproductions.com and Anthony's YouTube page. We'll be putting that on the side notes of the blog. And two forthcoming documentaries as well, By Spoon, The J. Mizell Story, and Wacky Man, The Rise of a Puppeteer. We've talked a little about Anthony and his work on the show before, but we're really excited for you to be on the show. So first, I want to thank you very much for taking time out, Anthony.
Oh, thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Absolutely. I will jump right into it. I guess first off, we did talk a little about My Comic Shop documentary, but would you like to kind of explain the doc itself and kind of what it's about for the audience?
Sure. Right. So it's called My Comic Shop documentary, and the AR in documentary are capitalized to reflect the name of the store that the movie is about. It's called Alternate Realities, and it's a comic book shop in Scarsdale, which is located in Westchester County in New York. I worked at the store after school and during summers, all throughout high school and college, and a little bit during law school as well. And I always felt that there was a story to tell. And the movie's really about the community that has developed over the years at Alternate Realities, just the colorful characters that have come in and out.
Very nice. So let me ask you, what got you interested in filmmaking or making documentaries?
I mean, I've really always, I feel I've always been interested in writing and filmmaking. In college, I majored in journalism, and pretty much any opportunity that I had, I would write about the store. And the people there. One of my journalism classes required a final project, and for that project, I wrote a 20-page profile of the owner of the store, Steve Odo.
Nice.
Who is focused, you know, who's featured heavily in the movie and is very much the protagonist and maybe antagonist at times of the film. And I wrote other papers about other people at the store, customers. And I think that was sort of the first time that I, you know, started figuring out how to tell the story and realizing that there were stories to tell there. And, you know, I mean, I never quite set out to be a documentarian. I just really set out to tell this particular story, but very much fell in love with the medium, with the format, and that's led to the subsequent projects.
Nice. Very cool. So you said law school. You graduated recently law school, which is very interesting since you're making documentaries about comic book shops. Is there some kind of connection there?
Yeah. Well, one slight connection is in that Steve was also a lawyer before opening the comic book shop. But now aside from that. Yeah, it's sort of been a weird combination, and people always that always raises eyebrows. I have graduated law school. I passed the New York bar exam. I'm not practicing at the moment. I'm actually working in admissions at my law school, trying to get other people to come. Yeah, it was an unusual path, but one that worked really well for me. I found that. It really provided an invaluable balance, you know, sort of not getting too crazy about either one thing, because I always had the other one to worry about as well.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a balance that worked well. And I've said this, and I really do believe, I don't think I would have been as productive in either area without the other one. So unorthodox though it was, you know, I feel it worked for me. And so I don't have any. I mean, the comic shop documentary was the first thing I ever shot or edited. I didn't have any prior filmmaking experience.
Oh wow, okay, that's great. Well, it's a special thing to be able to take a passion of yours, which I assume you like, enjoy comic books since you said you worked at the shop, and being able to create art or create something around that passion. So, I mean, kudos to you. I think it's great.
Oh, thanks. Yeah, I mean, I've been reading and collecting comic books since I was five. I talk about that in the opening narration of the movie, but I got into comics with the death of Superman, and you know, I've been reading ever since. And certainly, yeah, I mean, just the idea of passion, being able to, you know, tell the story of a place that I was so familiar with. You know, it wasn't as if I was some outsider coming in and trying to, you know, put these people under the microscope. It really came from from a positive place, and while at the same time hopefully being accessible for outsiders.
Oh yeah, I mean, that passion shines through in the documentary too, I think.
Oh, thanks.
So Don, I think, has a question.
Yeah, well, I'm trying to get past the fact this is your first project. That actually kind of shocks me. But you really got a feel for that whole comic shop thing. I feel like I'm a customer there. I love all the people that run it. But when you set this out, did you just film a lot of information and then put it together in the editing process? Or did you have a plan when you went into it?
Yeah, I mean, I did have a fairly detailed script when I started. I mean, as much as you can script a documentary, but it was basically an outline. Again, you know, one of the advantages of, you know, having spent so much time at the store is, you know, I knew the different aspects of life at Alternate Realities that I wanted to hit. And so that's sort of how I broke down the movie. And I had fairly specific ideas who I wanted to talk to within each section, what questions I wanted to ask. In some cases, there were, you know, there was particular imagery that I knew I wanted to show, but a lot of it also did come together in the editing process, especially the order of sequences and things like that. I played with that a lot, just trying to get, you know, as good a flow as possible. So it was a combination. I had a script, but a lot came together in the editing process, which was even more so than the filming. The editing process was fascinating to learn. You know, I feel that it involves a lot of the same skills that I used in the journalism classes and writing. But obviously has the technical component as well. But it's amazing. It can be frustrating and tedious, and I mean, it just takes forever. But it's amazing when you see, you know, what a difference a little change here or there can make. And so I really fell in love with that process.
Well, has it changed since you've done the other two documentaries from the first one? Have you done anything differently?
I mean, I guess this is really up for others to say. I mean, I like to think that I've gotten better in either the filming or the editing. I don't know. I hope so. As far as, you know, things I learned, I mean, basic stuff that I probably should have known at the start, but, you know, filming as much coverage as possible. I mean, you really can never have too much footage. You know, just to have B-roll to throw over when someone's talking, you know, stuff like that. So, you know, but again, just overall, just becoming more comfortable, you know, with the process of both the filming and the editing.
That's great.
Yeah, when I'm watching, I have to say on the documentary, it just caught me all the way through. I can't think of anything I wish you would have done differently or would have changed. I love the whole interaction of it. That's what surprised me. It was your first project. Very smooth. Well,
I appreciate that very much.
Yeah, it's very well put together, and I don't think it's a fluke that you've gotten so many hits recently on YouTube. I mean, it's growing. It really is on your YouTube page, and it's your question earlier about wondering if people outside of the comic book community would be enraptured by it or pulled in, and I think the answer would be yeah, they would be, because it's a very compelling documentary, And part and parcel is because you have very compelling subject material. I mean, the owner of the shop, all the guys that either work or shop there, you know, people want to hear their story. It's very interesting. It's fun to get a glimpse into these people's lives, and you do a great job of capturing that.
Oh, thanks. I mean, yeah, I they definitely gave me great material to work with. I mean, I really can't, you know, overstate that, just how important it was, you know, to get that material. And I mean, I really have to say, when I set out to make this, you know, all the people who are in it, and the people who aren't, but the people who are in it specifically, I mean, I don't think they knew what to expect, but they were all very supportive and they were on board. And, you know, I think when I showed up with the equipment, not that it's an extravagant setup by any means. I mean, it's about as simple as it gets, but I think when they saw how serious I was about it, I think, you know, it just something clicked. And, but yeah, they gave me such great material to work with. And, you know, Steve in particular, he was very open. I mean, I really had, you know, both in his interview and also just the access that he gave me to not only the store, but his home. And, you know, one of the things that was really important for me was, you know, again, I'm friends with all of these people. I worked at the store. I love the store. But at the same time, you know, I didn't want to just make a commercial for Alternate Realities.
Right.
So, mm-hmm. you know, in addition to wanting to keep it accessible, it is a documentary, and I wanted it to be lighter than certain other documentaries that you see. I wanted it to be fun and funny. But I did, you know, also want to show just to show all sides, and, you know, because of the freedom that I was given, especially by Steve, you know, I think I was able to do that. I mean, you really see all sides of him.
Oh yeah. And well, not to steal Don's thunder here, but just getting an in-depth perspective of running the comic shop itself and kind of the behind the scenes, and even showing that Steve has off the premises areas where, you know, he's got a locked room where he's got all of his excess product and whatnot. And, you know, at one point, you guys go over to a storage unit and find some of his excess stuff. And it's really cool to see this, and not everyone's privy to that kind of stuff. So it's nice. It's a glimpse inside of the owner's life, not just the comic shop itself.
Yeah. You know, it's funny. That brings a couple things to mind. You know, one of the reasons why, you know, for example, we went to the warehouse was, you know, I was setting out to make a feature length movie. I mean, it ended up clocking in at 72 minutes. But so I didn't want to have, you know, over an hour just at the store. So part of that was born out of just like, where else can we go? And then, but as far as the, you know, the behind the scenes aspect, I mean, I always knew that I wanted to show that, and I thought it would be interesting, but I kind of have been surprised by how many people have commented on that, like how it was cool to see what it's like to run a store. I guess maybe I took it for granted after a while, because I worked there for so long that it, you know, when I first started working there in high school, I felt that way. I was like, wow, this is, you know, it's amazing to be, you know, inside the store when it's locked and we're unpacking the new books. Like, that was so cool. But after a while, you get used to it. But that's been kind of cool to hear those reactions from people.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's not the only off-premises scene. I mean, you've got kind of a community building scene where they're all out at a restaurant. You know, all you guys go out to eat. And apparently, didn't they do it like, what was it, every Friday or something like that?
Yeah, every Saturday, more or less. Yeah, that's our big action scene when they all walk into the restaurant.
Awesome. Al, you've been a little silent. How you doing?
I'm doing all right. Well, okay, I got a question for you. When was this filmed?
This was filmed in summer 2010. And then, you know, well, and edited, mostly edited that summer as well. Although I would go back and, you know, continue to tweak it, since then. And, yeah, over the, you know, the previous few years, I mean, it, you know, played at a number of festivals, which were all a great experience and, you know, great opportunities to watch the movie with an audience, which was, fun and also informative as well. And then I just released the movie on YouTube back in May.
Now, did you have any experience with the video editing and the camera work and all that stuff, or was that just learned on the spot?
Yeah, that was on the spot. I pretty much just, taught myself as I went. I mean, I, again, was fortunate enough to be, we're at a point where, the technology is such that, you can get a decent camera, for and not break the bank. And, I edited on my Mac. And so that was very helpful. But yeah, I mean, really just, just grabbed the camera and did it. And, what I've always said about this was exactly the story that I wanted to tell, the way I wanted to tell it, to the best of my ability. And, even if it, no matter how it turned out, I would have been glad that I did it.
Sure, sure. Have any documentaries inspired you or inspired you to do this? Or was this just this done out of the love for the store?
Really out of the love of the store. I mean, I hate to say as a documentarian that I don't watch a lot of documentaries myself. I mean, certainly, I do watch the occasional documentary, but I mean, I can't say that I'm an avid documentary viewer. It, like you said, it really was just, the passion to tell this particular story.
Has anybody contacted you with any prospective work for hire or anything like that? Or, like anybody wants you to do a documentary for them or anything like that? Or
there have been a couple of things. I was fortunate enough to get, a decent amount of press, especially when the film was playing at festivals. And there was some interest here and there, but nothing that, that gained any traction.
Okay.
So that's why, I've continued to work on my own projects.
Well, Anthony, sorry, with our listenership of three people, that might all change for you.
Hey, you know what? That's three more views. I'll take him.
Now, the next one you've got coming up, the Jay Mizell, is that different in tone than this one, or is that, how far into it are you?
That's done. I'm finished with that. And yeah, it's so Jay Mizell, he's one of the characters who appears in my comic shop documentary. Yeah. He's the older curmudgeonly flea market vendor visits. Yeah, but Lovell, right, who visits alternate realities Mondays and Thursdays. And I kind of always had in the back of my head the idea that I wanted to do something just focusing on him. I kind of always figured that it would be a short. I thought that might be about as much as people could take. I finally started filming that, not this winter that just passed, but the one before. And initially, it was really just going to be a profile of him, just spending some more time with him at the market and going a little bit more into his backstory. And then last summer, we found out that the flea market was closing.
Spoiler alert. And,
yeah. that's all right. The trailer. That's my next point. I mean, that's really what the movie became, what it's about now. I resumed filming and documented his final days there. So even before the closing, but definitely once we found out about the closing, the tone is certainly darker and more somber than the first one. But it's still a lot of the same humor that was present in the first one is in the second. And, it's Jay, if you guys saw the movie, you're familiar with him. So it's sort of... you see the frustration and the sadness that he experienced, but he's still, cursing up a storm.
Yeah. I was going to say, he's got a mouth on him, so that's going to be entertainment right there.
Well, when Dan posted the link to the Jay Mizell story, I watched part of it and I stopped because I've been in so many shops like that when I was a kid. And I thought, I don't know. But then when I watched, the comic shop documentary all the way through and saw him, I guess I got more of a sympathetic thing to it. So I watched the whole thing. I actually like the guy quite well. I love how he tells people he sells art, which is, how I feel. Does he, when he goes to alternate reality, is he buying comics to sell or is he reading comics?
No, it's more that, the former. If he's looking for something that he doesn't have in his booth, he'll I mean, he goes to the alternate realities either way. It's more of a social thing at this point. He has lunch with Steve. But the secondary purpose is, you know, if he's sold out of something or didn't order something and a customer asked for it, he'll see if Steve has it.
Mm.
Cool. Now, is there a release date for the Finished by Spoon documentary yet?
Not yet. I'm not quite sure where, when, how that will happen. It's gotcha. Currently, I submitted it to a number of film festivals, mostly in the New York area. And I'm waiting to hear back about that. And I'd also love to get it, you know, into some comic conventions as well. Some festivals have screening opportunities. Some conventions have screening opportunities. Some actually even have festivals. Others, it's a little harder. I'm going to try to get it out there. With the first documentary, it's currently online in full for free. Because I really just wanted to get it out there and make it accessible as possible. Especially since I filmed it, you know, a while ago now. So I just wanted to get it out there. With this next one, I would certainly love to find some form of formal distribution, both to compensate myself, but also, just to get it out there to a wider audience. You kind of hit on this before, but the Comic Shop documentary, it's definitely been getting views, which is nice, because again, I could have put it out there and just gotten a couple hundred hits and that could have been the end of it. So, we're over 6,000 now, which is nice. And people seem to continue to find it and enjoy it, which just, you know, makes me feel even more that, you know, that there is an audience for this, and I would just like to get it out there, as widely as possible.
Mm-hmm.
So in your first movie, you introduced the shop and you introduced the characters. Are you going to be taking more people from the characters from the movie and making different documentaries on them, like more in depth? Or is it – I know you're doing Wacky Man also after the Jay Mizell.
Yeah. So right. Obviously, we have the Jay, which, again, technically it's a spinoff, though. I really do feel it stands on its own, and hopefully if there's anyone who, you know, didn't watch the first movie, I hope they wouldn't not watch By Spoon, you know, because right. of that. But Wacky Man, right, is the one after By Spoon, and as far as whether it's a spinoff or not, yes and no. The puppeteer in the title does actually appear in my Comic Shop documentary. He's the gentleman who goes on the rant about Captain America's wings.
Yeah.
So maybe it could be considered a spinoff, but it's really, you know, has nothing to do with, you know, with Zach's appearance in the Comic Shop documentary. It's really its own thing. And, for me, it's important. I want to tell different stories. A story about a puppeteer is about as different as it gets. It's, it's been a whole new world for me. You know, I know all about different kinds of puppets now, and it's been really interesting. I'm currently filming that now, so that's still a ways away, but it's been a lot of fun. The other day I interviewed Peter Linz. He's a professional puppeteer. He played Walter in the new Muppets movies.
So
it was just really interesting, and it's been fun, and I'm looking forward to continue, you know, putting that together.
That's great. And just like the Comic Shop documentary and By Spoon, there is a large crowd. There's an audience for that documentary, and it's I'm sure you'll find it. You know, it
might take a little while. Yeah. Well, it's interesting to people, I think. It's a world that maybe a lot of people don't know.
Yeah, the thing with the puppeteer one is, you know, it's not the first documentary about a puppeteer. There was, you know, Being Elmo about Kevin Clash, and there's a documentary about the puppeteer who does Big Bird as well that I know recently was making the film festival rounds. I don't know the status of that now, but, those are movies about established professional puppeteers. This takes a different angle and, you know, shows you the story of someone trying to make it. So hopefully, you know, it'll be interesting to people who are fans of that, but also give them, you know, again, just come at it from a different angle.
Great. All right, I have one last question for you, Anthony.
Yes.
So you worked at a comic shop. You have a passing interest in comics, at the least. What kind of comics do you or did you read?
I got into comic books with the death of Superman. So Superman's been my favorite character. I've probably read more Superman comics than any other character or series. I have to say my reading, the amount of reading that I do now is definitely less than it was before. But currently, Scott Snyder's Batman and Mark Waid's Daredevil are two of my favorites. I'm really, really enjoying those.
We always rave about Mark Waid on the show. He's such a solid, reliable writer. Always has been, I think, for the decades that he's been in the industry.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I mean, his Flash run is one of my favorites, and I mean, he's just done so much, and just a talented writer. I mean, explains why he's been around for so long.
It's true.
Has anything changed with the store since you did the documentary, like people leaving or anything like that, or is it basically still the same?
You know, it's interesting that you ask that, because it's something that as I was making my final edits to the documentary before I posted it on YouTube, obviously I'm, you know, watching it all again and taking it all in, and you know, there are, you know, a decent number of, not a lot, but a decent number of people who appear in the movie talking about how important the store is to them. And some of those people we don't see anymore for one reason or another. And
jerks.
And honestly, when I realized that, at first it made me kind of sad. But at the same time, it's, you know, and I think, you know, Steve even says something like this in the movie, people come and go, and some people you'll never see again. But for however long it was, you know, they were a part of the store and the store meant something to them. And so I don't know. I sort of made my peace with that. And, you know, the other thing, too, for me and for the people in the store, you know, the movie really is a time capsule of, you know, I mean, for me in particular, I mean, that summer was probably the most intense summer of my life making that movie. So as far as changes, there definitely are some people who aren't there anymore. Jeff Wong. We don't really see him too much anymore. And I can only speculate as to where he is. And
that's working for the Secret Service.
There's a movie there too.
it was fascinating. Yeah,
it's, well, you know, it's funny because a lot of people, you know, that was a spinoff that that some people requested, and I don't know. I feel that if I delved any deeper, it would ultimately be disappointing. I'd rather show what we showed and kind of leave this open question of like, is it true? Like some of it, you know, just kind of leave it to people's imagination. I don't know that we need to go any further than that.
Yeah, that was the way to go.
Yes.
Well, congratulations for finishing law school. Is that going to end the rest of any more filmmaking, or do you have any more plans?
No, I mean, you know, I graduated in 2012, and I've been working, you know, full time at the law school pretty much since then. And you know, I made By Spoon during that time, and making Wacky Man now. So it's definitely been harder to do this with a full time job. It was a lot even in law school. It was easier with the school schedule. I mean, again, the first movie I had, you know, the summer break, I had 3.5 months. I would kill for, you know, for a 3.5 month window to make a movie now. The thing I found, and I'm sure you guys would agree, you know, no matter what it is, if you want to do it badly enough, you find and you make the time somehow.
Yeah.
So this is something I enjoy to do, and you know, like Wacky Man, it'll however long it takes, I'll get it done. It's still something that I'm pursuing. I mean, this is ultimately what I would love to do for a living. If nothing else, I'm happy that I'm, you know, even if I just make it on my own and I put it on YouTube, at least I'm able to tell the stories. But, you know, I would like to do this for a living, to be able to devote, you know, all of my time to it and to reach more people. But we'll keep plugging away.
Do you write scripts, film scripts or anything?
Yeah, actually, the first screenplay I ever wrote was in college. Again, as part of the journalism program, I took a screenwriting class. It was about a disgraced police detective who opened a comic book store. So,
yes.
You know, well, they say write what you know. So that was the first screenplay I ever wrote, and really had a great time doing that. That's something that I would love to do. I do have an idea for a non-documentary, a narrative film that I hope to get into after Wacky Man. So yeah, that's definitely something that I'm interested in. And as far as other documentaries, there's nothing specific in mind at this point. But like I said, I love the format, and I'd certainly be open to doing more.
I have a quick question. How did the police inspector do on his comic shop? Was it successful?
Well, I'm sorry?
Was it successful?
The
the disgraced police officer.
Yeah, I'm sitting there thinking.
Yeah, he did all right. He did all right.
Okay, that's I was just curious.
So Flat Squirrel Productions, which is flatsquirrelproductions.com. That is your production company, correct?
Yes, that takes its name from Steve. He has a number of Otoisms, sayings that he lives his life by, and one of them is hesitation kills. And he tells the parable of the flat squirrel who was trying to make it across the road and couldn't decide to go for it or not, and ends up getting flattened. And just kind of the idea of the flat squirrel kind of always stuck with me. I mean, as you saw in the movie, the Otoisms run the gamut. Some are more profound and have value, and I think that's one of them. Others are sillier. But so that one always stood out to me. So that's how I came up with the name for the production company.
Well, listeners can find the entire My Comic Shop documentary on Flat Squirrel Productions, along with trailers for, I believe, both by Spoon and Wacky Man. Is that right?
Yes.
Great. Do you have any other places? I know you have a YouTube page, right?
Yeah, I have a YouTube channel. My Comic Shop documentary and By Spoon also have Facebook pages. Wacky Man will have a Facebook page soon. I'm on Twitter. It's at Desi Westside. And I think that about covers it.
Great. We're going to pimp all that stuff and put it on our website as well, on the links on the sidebar as usual. Anthony, it's been a pleasure. I want to thank you so much for being a gentleman and taking time out of your day to kind of chat with us. And I think from all of us, I want to say congratulations. We wish you good luck on your ventures and the next couple of documentaries. We're really looking forward to seeing them.
Oh, thank you very much. I appreciate it, guys. Thank you.
And anytime you want to be back on the show and hang out and just talk shop, just let us know. We'd love to have you on.
All right. Thanks. I'll take you up on that.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Anthony. And guys, we're going to take a music break, and then we're going to come back with Don and Al.
No milk today. My love has gone away. The bottle stands forlorn, a symbol of the dawn. No milk today. It seems a common sight, but people passing by don't know the reason why. How could they know just what this message means? The end of my hopes, the end of all my dreams. How could they know a palace there had been behind the door where my love reigned as queen? No milk today, it wasn't always so. The company was gay, we turned that into day. But all that's left is a place dark and lonely. A terraced house in a mean street back of town becomes a shrine when I think of you only. Just too up, too down. No milk today, it wasn't always so.
the company was gay. We turned out into day. As music played, the faster did we dance. We felt it both at once, the start of our romance. How could they know just what this message means? The end of my hopes, the end of all my dreams. How could they know a palace had been behind the door where my love reigned as queen? No milk today, my love has gone away. The bottle stands forlorn, a symbol of the dawn. But all that's left is a place dark and lonely. A terraced house in a mean street back of town becomes a shrine when I think of you only. Just too up, too down. Just too up, too down.
You can hear our most recent 20 episodes on iTunes. If you want to hear our older episodes, you can find them at our blog on bunchofdorks.com.
And that was Graham Gouldman from his album The Graham Gouldman Thing from 1968 with No Milk Today, a song he wrote for Herman's Hermits.
Who was Graham Gouldman?
Graham Gouldman was a songwriter from the 60s who later became a member of 10cc. He's still around. I think he actually tours with a version of 10cc where he's the only original member. But hey, you know, a lot of bands do that these days. But yeah, he wrote No Milk Today, Bus Stop, For Your Love, and a few other hits for like some more popular bands in the 60s. And then, like I said, he went on to do 10cc. So there you go.
Cool.
Now it's time for comics.
Time for comics.
Comics. Well, I found out some stuff. And I'll share it with you and the audience here. Yesterday we were at the comic book store, Wilson's Comic Book Store in St. Petersburg.
Wilson's Book World in St. Pete.
Yep. You can find them online, I'm sure. And
on the sidebar of our
blog. And on the sidebar, yeah. So we were looking around. I found some issues of – they have a bunch of Archies.
Yeah.
So I was looking through them. For a dollar, yeah. All the back issues are a dollar. And so I'm just looking through them to see if they have, like, Dan DiCarlo or Harry Lucy or Sam Short. So I find these issues of Laugh that were like from the late 70s, and I see Harry Lucy stories in them. I go, wow, I thought I was sure he had passed away by 77 or something, or he wasn't working, but there was reprint. There were reprints in there. So I'm like, oh, that's cool. Even though there are only 5-page reprints in each issue, I just said, well, that's worth a buck to me. I love Harry Lucy. So anyway, I'm looking through them, and they're all great and wonderful, but I noticed the first artist, this guy here, who I've seen his work, tons of Archie, and I never knew who he was. So I'm going like, oh, okay, well, that's cool, you know. But then I look in the back, and then when I'm looking at the Lucy, I go, well, I wonder who did all this art, because it looks like Harry Lucy, but it looks like somebody inked it. Well, it's our old pal Chick Stone was actually the inker on a lot of the Harry Lucy stories in the late 70s.
How did you find this out?
Grand Comics Database.
Wow.
So, yeah. So, like, Chick Stone was like all-encompassing artist. Like, he did Kirby. He drew stories. He did Archie-like characters in the 50s. He inked Harry Lucy. He was an all-around great man, a great collaborator.
Wow. Yeah, he did it all.
Yeah, he did. Yeah,
he did
yeah.
it well.
Yeah, he sure did.
I never knew he went for Archie. What Al's always talking about, he inked the early Fantastic Fours for a long time, which I think you say he is your favorite Kirby inker.
Well, he's one of my favorites. Mm-hmm. Top five.
Yeah, in the top. In mine as well. I really like Chick Stone. I know he drew Nemesis, a comic called Nemesis.
Yeah, yeah. Uh-huh.
I think the 60s. And I've seen his name all the time, but I never knew he did Archie work.
Yeah, he did. I guess he did it in the 70s. But like I said, he was probably collaborating. Now, I'm going to investigate and see if he actually drew any stories on his own. But it looked like he was inking other people. But I also read on Grand Comics Database, but I couldn't find the book, that he did some of the – he worked on some of the Archie superhero books, too, in some form or another. So that makes sense because he was a superhero artist or whatever, you know, but yeah, it's good stuff. And the bad part about this is, like, the artist that I wanted to talk about who did all those stories was Dick Malmgren, who did a ton of work for Archie's, in the 70s, 80s, and I'm sure in the 90s too, but he's a good Archie artist. He's not one of the superstars, as it were, but he did a lot of work, and I just wanted to make sure he'd been mentioned, because I found all these years I never knew who he was, and now I went to Grand Comics database and found out who he was.
Well, when you showed it to me, I've seen his work. A lot of times I buy Archie, I get it, but he was one of the artists I never knew. He wasn't one of my favorite Archie artists, but he was good. But I've never heard his name before.
Yeah, it's funny because I was looking through the comics database and I found credits for this issue, but some of these other ones, they had no credits. So I guess somebody must have like went in and done written this one up. But these definitely don't have credits. But you can, if you look at the art, it's the same guy. So yeah, and then also in this issue is Little Jinx by Joe Edwards, who was doing the book since the character since 1947 yeah. till the end. So yeah, that's another kind of unsung hero of Archie Comics.
For Little Jinx, I've seen in old ads and stuff. She had her own book.
Okay.
And sometimes they'd have stories in Archie of Little Jinx. It'd be like, you know, 4 or 5 pages, but at the least they'd always have half a page. It'd be half a page of Little Jinx, and they'd have two daily strips from the Archie newspaper. And there'd sometimes be a full page, but it always ran. But Little Jinx, she was a well thought out character. The guy was a really good artist. It was a unique style, and I always thought that was kind of odd that it was always an Archie. I guess they couldn't keep the book on sale, but he continued to do strips for it all the way.
Oh yeah, all
the
way till yeah. And I noticed that the cover, I think it's this one. Maybe it was that one. It's obviously Dan DiCarlo, but it said inks by John DiCarlo. So his son.
Oh, Jim DiCarlo.
Jim DiCarlo. So yeah. His son inked his work, huh?
Yeah, there was a period where I think it was late 70s.
That's what these are.
Yeah, because Dan DiCarlo Jr. was penciling as well.
His family.
He looked like Dan DiCarlo. He was really good, but it's like any time. Sometimes you see kids doing the same work as their dad. It's good, but it's missing that one little spark.
Oh, yeah.
When I say that, I really like Dan DiCarlo Jr. I used to see it and buy his. But Jim DiCarlo was inking, too. But they only did it, I think, for a few years, and they went on and did other things.
Oh, okay. Because the work by Dan DiCarlo I liked the best is when he was inked by Rudy LePage.
Yeah, he was my favorite as
well. Yeah, he was a really good inker. They worked well together. They're the ones who did all the classic. And Dan DiCarlo had like a classic style. You know, I'm not going to say he invented that style, but I don't remember ever seeing too many do. I guess it was in the Archie vein or whatever, but he definitely like perfected a style that's the archetype.
He was like, he didn't invent the style, but he made it his own.
Yeah, yeah.
But his sons did a very good work. If they would have kept going, they would have been top talent.
I think one of them passed away.
Oh, really?
I think so, yeah. I'm not 100% sure, but I think I read that one of the sons passed away, and then I think Dad's passed away, too. So,
yeah,
I mean,
DiCarlo died a few years ago.
Yeah, and we were talking before that with the wife was the model for Josie.
Her name was Josie.
Josie, yeah, that's pretty funny.
Yeah, she was French. He met her in the World War II.
Oh, is that what it is?
Yeah, he was in the Army, and he met her, but she was a redheaded French lady.
Yeah, and I still have those magazines. I didn't even realize that he did this. But again, we talked about this before. Was those Humorama magazines that were like those that Dan DiCarlo, because he was working for Atlas doing like Jetta and some other
Sherry the Showgirl.
Yeah, yeah, right. With Stan Lee and whoever else was writing. I guess it was Stan Lee. I don't know.
Yeah,
but then Humorama. I later found out, which was like a little jokey men's kind of digest size magazine. That was Martin Goodman publishing them, though, so it was within the Marvel family.
We were talking about that on the Archie thing. We didn't really understand. So it was the men's magazines that Martin Goodman was publishing.
That's right.
Those cartoons are really nice looking.
They're great, yeah. They're kind of off-putting at first because it looks like Betty and Veronica, like, you know, like
with big shoulders and big breasts.
Yeah, like and nothing much else on. And,
yeah.
and they're just like goofing on old guys, so it's just like, I guess that was whatever.
Yeah, old
humor.
Guys with young women.
Yeah, yeah. Right. You know, no, you know, whatever, you know. But anyway, yeah, those Humorama magazines are Martin Goodman, so that's the connection there between, you know, Atlas, Archie, and Dan DiCarlo. Dan DiCarlo and Atlas Comics. I think he went to Archie in the late 50s, early 60s, and then that was it. That was all he did. Same with Lucy. Harry Lucy probably probably went to Archie a little around the same time, and that was all he'd think.
Well, Harry Lucy did some superhero strips before that.
But what, for Archie?
Well, I don't know if it was Archie.
I can't. I don't remember right now. I don't know. I mean, I'm talking about the Archie work. I got a feeling those two guys came around the same time, maybe.
You know, there's some. You just mentioned about this Archie artist you never heard of. There was a couple of stories. I just saw a few in random Archie magazines that I thought, I'd like to see more work by this person. And I'm just thinking, I wish there was a list of all the Archie artists and what year they worked and what stories they did.
Okay, well, I know I was, when I was looking through the Wikipedia or the internet, they mentioned Henry Scarpelli did work. And Henry Scarpelli did stuff for DC. Like, I'm not sure if he did Scooter or Wendy or Wendy or whatever, but he did Archie-like stories for DC.
Yeah, and I don't remember. Did he work for Archie too?
He worked for Archie also. Yeah.
I knew the name. I've seen. I knew. I remember he did a lot of that DC work. Yeah, it was Wendy and Willie, wasn't it?
Yeah, I think it was Wendy and Willie.
It was because he found that Dobie Gillis comic and they redid it as Wendy and Willie.
Yeah. That was that. They actually took Ochsner's work, whatever. But I think it was. Mm-hmm. It was one of those, like, Willie or Wendy or something, and they did it in, like, an Archie style, and Andrew Scarpelli did all of those. So, yeah, he later went on to... A lot of these guys that were working for DC and such ended up moving to Archie because it was just, like, work, you know? Same with Chick Stone. He ran out of work, so he went to Archie, and he started inking.
Well, that's what happened. Terry Austin and John Workman Jr.
They worked for Archie?
Both worked for Archie doing the Sonic the Hedgehog and stuff.
Yeah, I can't believe Terry Austin wasn't getting any work.
I don't know if he wasn't getting any work or if he just wanted to do Archie.
Maybe that's it.
But he was good friends with Dan DiCarlo.
Maybe that's it then. Because, I mean, after a certain point, after, like, Byrne and a few other things, he went over to D.C. and inked a few things, but he stopped doing superhero work, didn't he, Terry Austin?
He still did a lot of stuff. I remember he was inking on... Carl Potts on that last, The Last Dragon or whatever it was, an Epic Illustrator.
I remember that.
That was nice. And he inked Frank Miller. He was inking Marshall Rogers for the Doctor Strange stuff. I saw Terry Austin all the time. And yeah, he went to DC.
But by the mid 80s, he just kind of like,
well, I remember in the early 90s.
Maybe late 80s.
Late 90s when the Superman animated series was out. DC had a book called Superman Adventures. I think Rich Burkett was drawing it, and Terry Austin was the inker on that book.
Boy, I guess it must be like that Byrne thing. You know, he's so closely associated with Byrne that I forgot about all the other work that he did. I remember the Miller. It was like a what-if story, I think. What if
Electra? Well, he inked that, but he also inked the last story that Frank Miller did for Daredevil, where him and Bullseye were doing Russian Roulette.
Okay, yeah.
And that was the thing. Terry Austin was one of my favorite inkers. And that's one thing my friends and I were talking about, and Britt had mentioned. He says Terry Austin proved he can ink anybody and make them look good, which is true. Frank Miller had a completely different style than John Byrne and, you know, Marshall Rogers and Carl Potts. But you put Terry Austin on it, he'll do it. I mean, he still, you can tell it's Terry Austin, but he doesn't overpower and change it to a Terry Austin piece.
Yeah, he did that Toth thing, too, for DC. That was real nice, too. You know who was a really... This guy's a really great anchor anyway, Tom Palmer. But I was going through a book the other day. I just found it in the room over there. And the art was beautiful. It was Marshall Rogers, inked by Tom Palmer with Scorpio Rose.
Oh, yeah, I remember that.
What a nicely done book. Yeah, Eclipse put it out. Yeah, I only think I had the first issue. I got to look for those because the artwork is beautiful. They combine well together. I mean, Marshall Rogers is an artist that I like, but sometimes he just seemed a little too cartoony for my taste. But when he combined with Palmer, he gave that right cartoony illustrative look that I really enjoyed a lot, and the design was beautiful.
See, I always remember Marshall Rogers is really tight.
Yeah.
He just got tighter and tighter, which I liked. I didn't like everything he did, but there was some of the stuff he did. The Batman work he did with Steve Englehart was nice. And then they put it out, I think, as a 5-issue recollection. He did the wraparound colors, covers. Those were strong.
He was very design.
Yeah, which is something I loved. And he wasn't somebody that just used stock figures. I remember one thing I liked. He had a portfolio I bought. Even back when portfolios were the big thing. I think it was called Strange. And it was like 5 different illustrations, but it's like you see the figures, and then it was like Steve Ditko looking architecture everywhere, and Odd Angles. I don't know. I just thought he's wonderful. I didn't like everything he did, but I liked a lot of it. You know?
Yeah, I didn't like the Doctor Strange as he did with Terry Austin.
See, I did like those.
I just thought they were, like, okay.
You know, well, I enjoyed them.
Yeah.
But I know Dallas doesn't really care for Marshall Rogers too much. The stuff he did for Eclipse, he was doing that Captain Quick and the Fizzle.
That was okay.
See, I wanted to like them, but I didn't.
It was
care
all right. I mean, it wasn't great, but it was okay. Mm-hmm. But the Scorpio Rose stuff I liked. I mean, like I said, I want to find. He did another thing for Eclipse where it was or maybe it was for Marvel, two female characters. They were like action heroes. I forgot what it was called. It was in one of their like black and white books.
Well, I don't remember that.
I gotta find it. I can't remember what it was. That was okay, but I think that was inked by maybe Bob McLeod. That whole thing about artists and inkers, which was so cool back then. I guess it's still around today in a way, but most of the stuff today is just an artist doing the entire book. You know, there's not as much collaboration that I can remember, because I don't read every book anymore or look at every book like I used to back then when I ran a comic book shop, when I looked at every book because that's part of my job.
Huh.
And then they were cheap, and I worked there, so
oh,
I could read them.
You're reading other people's books? They weren't mint anymore. What if
no,
the person didn't
no,
read them
they
and just
mint.
Collected?
Well, as long as they pay, whenever they pay their money, that's their responsibility at that point.
Poor people.
Well, I would treat them gently. I would wear gloves. I would have my surgical gloves, you know, snapped, you know, okay.
No, I'll be a circuit. Comics should be read. If they didn't read them and put them in a bag of board, then...
And more than likely, I just looked at the pictures anyway. God, so that's my little art tribute to Archie and Dick Malmgren and Joe Edwards and Chick Stone and Harry Lucy. So what
nice,
do you got, man?
Nice. Well, this is a book that I was wanting to get. I was kind of excited and apprehensive at the same time. It was Gru versus Conan by Sergio Aragonés, Mark Evanier, and Tom Yates. And on the cover, you know, it has Sergio Aragonés Gru fighting Conan, which is drawn by Tom Yates. I have honestly never been a big fan of one strip where different characters are drawn by different people. And, you know, Gru's done in the Sergio Aragonés style that I love. Conan is drawn in the Tom Yates style that I really grew to like quite a bit. But on Facebook, they, you know, talk about it, and, you know, these pictures have been rolling around for years. Sergio Aragonés hurt his back, you know, from drawing so much over, you know, so many years. And I guess he had to stop the project. And then when he was ready to do it, Tom Yates was busy, I imagine, with the Prince Valiant strip and couldn't get to it. So this thing's been floating around for quite a while. And on Facebook, they were talking about this getting ready to roll. And somebody said, I wish Sergio just would have drawn Conan as well, which is what I thought. I'd rather just be Conan show up in the strip. But when you read the book, it was done exactly the way it should have been done, because the first couple of pages, or few pages.
Beautiful.
Yeah, Tom Yates draws. And Tom Luth colors it, who colors Gru. But it's a real lush Richard Corbin-looking airbrush color. And then at one point, Conan saves this girl, and they're leaving this castle that, you know, all this stuff happened. And then it starts showing Gru characters
nice.
Looking through the bushes. And, well, that's kind of neat. Well, then it switches over, and it shows, you know, the Gru strip in the village, and he's drawn by Sergio Aragonés. And then all through the part, he keeps talking about they need a champion, and Gru's messing everything up because he sided with the wrong person. So these guys slip back over to the Richard Corbin-looking Tom Yates-colored world and talk to Conan to come back over. And I thought, I didn't see that coming. I really like this. It's a four-issue series.
Is that part one?
Yeah, that's part one. But I'm telling you, it's not what I thought it would have been. And but Conan and Gru haven't met, but the worlds have kind of come in. But I really enjoyed how they put it together. And like I said, when Tom Luth colors the Gru stuff, he colors it like he always did, with some of the flat colors and some modeling. But whenever it's the Tom Yates work, it looks like heavy airbrushing. It reminds me again like Richard Corbin's work in Den. You know.
Is Tom Yates going to be working on all four issues?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Right. Yeah, I think they got all four in the can, because they're talking about Sergio Aragonés, I guess, had the first two. pretty much done, or the first one and half of the second one. And then, like I said, he had the back injury and had to, you know. One I read on Mark Evanier's blog was, it was all those years of 16-hour days humped over a drawing table, and he started having back issues, and he had to get off his back. Which, hey, good enough. A lot of work.
Well, yeah, a lot of drawing panel borders on the magazine. That's a backbreaking
and
job.
How he never run out of ideas is what, when he first started in Gru, as I said, I thought, well, this is neat. Each issue is neat, but I says, after a while, you're going to run out of ideas. Well, he did, what, 150 issues almost, you know, and he never stopped. And then when he stopped doing Gru, he was always doing other projects. He never stops. I just, you know, I like his artwork.
He's going to be in his 70s, right?
Yeah, I think so. And so still drawing, and it's still just as, to me, he just
still
gets
just
better.
As good.
Well,
better,
he always gets better. You know?
Yeah, yeah. The panels are nice. I was looking through them. I was like, wow, you still got it. You still got it doing good on it.
Yeah, Serge Reganez, I love you, and thank you for continuing on and being awesome. All right, the next one is something I've talked about. I've always wanted to get. It was Ragnarok, the Walt Simonson book from IDW. You know, Walt Simonson's a huge fan of Norse mythology. That's what he read as a kid. And everybody knows the fantastic run on Thor he did. And but this one he did, it's called Ragnarok. It's Thor's. It has Thor's hammer. But he wrote and drew and inked it. John Workman did the lettering. And can you look and see who did the coloring on it?
Yes, I will.
It's a well-known colorist.
Laura Martin.
Laura Martin.
Yeah, she's been doing work for a while.
Now, I've seen the pencil pages and the ink pages.
Letterer is more John Workman.
Yeah. And but Walt Simonson has been posting the thumbnails and the pencil pages and the ink pages on Facebook. Really nice. I was a little turned off when I got the book because the first three pages, the coloring is what I always complain about, the over-colored. But what they did is they try to make it, they were telling a story in the past, so it's a lot of tans and browns and overcoloring. And John Workman, he wrote the script. It looks more like chiseled in stone or something, which I don't know. I was just being kind of intolerant, not wanting to read it. It's good. But anyway, I picked the book up, read the first three pages, and after that, it turns into the regular Walt Simonson crisp line work.
Well, the good thing, since John Workman lettered it, this is hand lettered. This isn't computer lettered, I don't think.
Well, no, he works on a computer, but he says sometimes it's just some lettering he doesn't like with the computer, so he hand letters it on the computer.
Okay, yeah, because some of the text has imperfections. Now maybe he did an alphabet, loaded it into the computer with his imperfections and put it in there, but it does look more. Does look more hand-lettered than usual.
Yeah, but he says sometimes he goes there and manipulates the text and then hand letters in the program. But the strip, Thor's not even in it at the beginning. He was talking about the Black Elves. It's a female. It's basically a married couple with a small child. And the child's not wanting the mother to go. The mother armors up. She's an assassin. Her husband's an assassin, too, but somebody had to stay with the baby. So she goes, and they're basically talking about she's taking the task, but she's going to need, people with her. And so she basically takes this army with her. And it has everything in it. It's actually, the story's really lush. It's alien. It's nothing like the Thor work. And it finally shows Thor's hammer, and it's like it was in the mythology. You know, the troll that made it, or the dwarf that made the hammer. The joke was he made the handle too short, so Thor had to get a strap to use it. But it's tied up to some type of door with all these chains on it. And I just, you know, like I said, whenever Walt Simonson was drawing energy, he's got all these ellipses and, you know, vectors everywhere. It's just beautiful. The problem is I read it. Once I got past the first three pages, I just zoomed through it. What, that's it? I got to wait?
Is he still doing? Is IDW still putting out Star Slammers?
Yeah, it's still going.
There's like a big Walt Simonson renaissance going on.
Well, it's he's never stopped, but I'm glad that IDW's putting. I'm hoping that when he finishes this, I don't know how long. I guess this is a limited series, But if it is, I hope he'll do some new Star Slammers work after they finished it. But
yeah.
I highly recommend it. If you like Walt Simonson, don't even hesitate. Just get it. If you haven't read Walt Simonson, take a look at it. I think you might like it.
Yeah, from the 70s, Simonson and Chaykin are still going strong.
Yeah.
They haven't stopped.
No.
I mean, there's a few others, Kaluta and stuff like that.
And they never stopped being good. Never stopped
being
good.
No, well, they were good from the beginning, so.
Yeah, but they never lost that spark. And Kaluta's as well. Have they ever published reprinted Kaluta's Carson Davina stuff? Ever?
Nope. They should. They haven't.
You know, I knew.
I have them. I downloaded them from a website.
Really?
I have all the stories, but no, they have not put them out on there.
Because I.
But they don't own ERB anymore. They don't have the rights to ERB
that's
anymore.
The issue, isn't it? I wish Dark Horse would put them out.
Yeah.
Because I've seen a couple of stuff from Kaluta. You know, like whenever I get Weird Worlds, you'd find one. But some of the pages you gave me for the blog.
Unbelievable.
And yeah, and it, just fantastic. And one thing I never realized, I really love Michael Kaluta's title work. You know, like when a story starts and he writes. I mean, I've always liked it, but I just never realized that that was one of the elements
of the design. Yeah.
You know, that's one thing when he put out his Metropolis.
That book was beautiful.
It was beautiful, but I was talking to him when he had done it, and I told him, "See, that's an issue I have is doing the logo work and stuff like he does, and the lettering." And I was, you know, basically giving a comment how good it was. That's something I have trouble with. And he said, "No, he says what you have to remember is you have to work just as long and hard on this as you do on this." He's pointing at the drawings. He's saying that, you know, everybody likes to draw, but the logo and stuff, everybody just kind of knocks out. So you have to spend just as much as time and effort and work on this as you do on the drawings. Oh, yeah. Right, so the master spoke.
Yeah, no, and he's one of those guys. There's a blog called The Golden Age. He posts a lot of scans. He's on there. If you look through a search engine, which I think he has on there, you can find the Carson of Venus stories on there. And he just posted, I think yesterday or today. Remember back in the 70s and 60s, they used to have these little digest-sized science fiction magazine called Fantastic and
oh, yeah,
If
yeah.
and all that. Well, back 69, 70, 73, whatever, Jones and Kaluta and I think more so Jones and Kaluta did a lot of single illustrations for him
yeah.
and a few covers. He posted a lot of those on there the last couple of days. So yeah, the Golden Age Blogspot, go on there and check it out. It's a very good website for artwork. He's got a lot of like yeah. those guys and then classic illustrators and then, but somewhere in there is the Carson and Venus stories, all of them. I think it's 9 stories.
Wow.
Yeah.
All right.
I think and you can go to my blog, Destination Nightmare, and if you look where the blog list, it'll have the Golden Age on there. Just click on it, go on there and search for it. So yeah,
there
it's
you
definitely
go.
There. Okay, so what do you got? What's next? Oh yeah, good, really good one.
Well, the only thing.
They're all good, but
yeah,
I actually read this one.
Yeah. Al told me about this book. I'm a big Alan Davis fan. I think Al likes him too.
Yes.
But I'm the kind, if Alan Davis works on it, I basically buy it sight unseen. But he did so far 2 issues of the Savage Hulk. I found them the other day and picked them up and. You know, one thing about Alan Davis, when he started doing that comic, Clandestine, you know, about the family, you know, out of England, I remember a friend of mine had the first issue, and I hadn't gotten it yet. He said, "Well, you can read mine." And I read it, and I brought it back. He said, "What do you think?" "Oh, it's really good." I says, "Boy, it really read fast." And he says, "Yeah, it's all of his work tends to do that." That's one thing, Alan Davis, and when I say that, his work, he puts a lot into it. The drawings are beautiful. They're always well thought out. I was reading in Modern Masters, when he does a strip, he builds dioramas, you know, so you can draw, like, cityscapes and places. He builds the whole...
He builds the... So you
yeah.
do 3D perspective.
Yeah, he was a model builder.
Oh, know? I didn't know that. That's
sometimes,
pretty cool.
Sometimes he was talking about it. He built little figures and stuff in it. That's...
Wow.
But that's a lot of work to do before you start drawing the strip, and I think he's very
works,
fast.
Works.
But he's to me one of the greatest writer artists around, and his work's always consistent. It never gets bad. He always
especially
has,
with Mark Farmer's ink, you know,
yeah, well, Mark
who's
Farmer,
great on his own in his own way, because he was inking some of the Mark Bagley Fantastic Fours that
yeah.
came out a couple of years ago or a year ago, and they were beautiful too. So
yeah, they're a great team. But you know, Alan Davis, he always has great compositions, great layouts. The stories just flow. The stories are just as well thought out as the artwork. But I read these two issues of Savage Hulk, and they just flowed by.
It's his tribute to the Neil Adams X-Men.
Yeah, well,
that's what hooked me when I saw it.
Yeah, when Al was telling me about the Neil Adams X-Men that he did, and I guess that was the early 60, 70s or late 68, 60s.
68, late
60s.
68, 69.
But the first issue, when you open up, they always, Marvel has those introductory pages, and it's telling a story, and it has the cover to X-Men 66.
That doesn't look like a Neil Adams issue, but that's the issue that this story springs from. Maybe Neil did the insides of it, but around that time is when he was doing all the Roy Thomas. It was Roy Thomas and Neil Adams, X-Men.
But anyway, I guess the Hulk shows up in the X-Men. I never read those issues. But I think basically it's like we're talking about where Walt Simonson always thought about the Odin Sword, or Paul Grist was thinking about Union Jack and Baron Blood.
Yeah.
And I think this is one of those where Alan Davis wanted to do more of the story for what happened then.
That's a great idea, actually.
It was, but it starts out with a picture of the cover, and then he's telling about what happened. The story's actually really neat.
Yeah.
And it has the first issue, he's fighting the Abomination, which as a kid, I never have been a fan of the Incredible Hulk. I mean, I liked him, but to me, I like the Hulk when he's fighting the Fantastic Four or the Avengers. I mean, that's, you know, I'm saying that I did read the single issues at times, but one time my dad, the company he worked for, they had a company truck, and one day he just came in and handed me a stack of Incredible Hulks. These are the ones that are inked by John Severin.
Oh man, those are nice.
And, he says here, because he knew I like comics, and he just gave me the stack. And at the time, I didn't really read Marvels. Right. And I read every one of them. It had the Hulk versus Everybody issue, you know, and but it had the Abomination. I remember Gil Kane drew it, and the Abomination scared me to death. And it even had the man to turn to the Abomination, you know, and it was just kind of a...
Wasn't the leader, wasn't he also Gamma Ray?
Yeah, he was another Gamma Ray, because everybody was green. The Abomination was kind of green-gray. And and the leader's
in
the second
in there too,
issue.
Yeah.
The leader was always one I'm thinking, really, that's the best you could come up with, this guy with his tall head, you know?
Well, he's got the genius big head DC syndrome, kind of.
Yeah, but it wasn't the light bulb head, but...
No.
You know, and he was always green, but... yeah, but in this one, the leader kind of terrifies me a little bit. But the Abomination as a kid, the man was a very aggressive, you know, in-your-face kind of man, and then he turned to the Abomination. And I didn't know too much about the guy. I know he hates the Incredible Hulk, and that's one thing Jean Grey was saying when she read his mind. This man hates the Hulk. He wants him dead. And the Abomination is always trying to show that he was superior. Of course, he never was, but he was superior in frightening looks.
You know what was really frightening when I was a kid? I was used to kind of like the Hulk that Kirby did, and I forgot who did it afterwards, but when I saw the Gil Kane Hulk, that was weird, okay? Because he had that style, and it just struck me for, like, I love Gil Kane, and I love those Hulks now. When I was a kid, that was like, oh, wow.
Yeah, it did. The way he drew the Hulk was a little, that's what I said, the Abomination. He drew those Abominations.
Yeah, he did those, yeah, that's what I mean. They're fighting on a cover.
Was he the one that designed the Abomination, or was it somebody else?
He may have been, I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know, but I always attest it to Gil Kane.
Yeah, those are freaky.
Yeah, it's the Hulk I like is when Steve Rude draws him. He kind of went back to the way Jack Kirby drew it, with the kind of the higher forehead and the deep-set eyes, kind of like a Frankenstein type, a cartoony version. I've seen some other guys draw the Hulk the same way, but I always attest it to Steve Rude. But other than that,
Steve Rude draws everything great in his Loomis. Yeah. We were talking about Loomis yesterday, too. Yeah. Andrew Loomis, those great art books.
Steve Rude's another artist that he does a lot of thinking before he draws it. I really liked when he did, I think him and Mark Evanier did the World's Finest miniseries. Yeah. It's a miniseries for DC. You know, like we talked about last episode, Superman and Batman were always a team. To me, they'll always be a team. But Mark Evanier, or was it Dave Gibbons? It was Dave Gibbons that wrote it.
Okay.
But it was a three-issue, you know, old square-bound, you know, series. But it was Superman and Batman meeting. But that was the first time I saw since the 40s where they drew Batman like the old Batman, the old style. And then he drew Superman the way Joe Shuster used to draw him, or like the Flasher
cartoons. Yeah, like the Flasher cartoons.
And
that
I was so really great. Surprised at that, but I loved it. And then, you know, he had the Joker and Lex Luthor and all that and all the stuff going on, but it was a great story. And I remember he even drew Metropolis as this bright, shining beacon in Gotham. He drew it like, well, you know, really terrifying and dark and scary and a lot of sharp angles. And I wish now people do all the time, but it back in 1980, 88 or 89, I never saw anybody doing that kind of work. So, like I said, Steve Rude, he always researches, he always thinks, which I'm guessing maybe drives some editors crazy, but he really puts a lot into it. And like I said, his Hulk is just the same way. He did a miniseries called Superman vs. Hulk. It was a crossover.
That one I never saw.
But it was quite good. But that's when I started seeing him draw the Hulk the way he draws it. And it kind of goes back to the early Jack Kirby issues, you know.
So he was drawing the Hulk in the Jack Kirby style of the Hulk, as opposed to Maurice Severin.
Yeah, which I liked. I loved it when the Severins worked on
the
Hulk.
I did too. Now, what was really weird, and I didn't notice that as a kid, you remember the Hulk Annual number one, which I bought when I was a kid, where Hulk's like holding up the letters with his name on the cover? Steranko did it. Well, Maurice Severin did the face.
I didn't know that.
That was another one of those retouch-up jobs, yeah. But it works.
Yeah.
Maurice Severin is an unsung hero or heroine.
Yeah, she absolutely was. And a lot of stuff I love she did, but I don't think she...
She did a lot of work on Call. She inked a lot of stuff. She colored for EC.
I bought those because she penciled the Call stuff. And John.
And then John, yeah. But, and she did work on Doctor Strange, too.
But the friend of ours that was an editor at Crack Magazine,
Lane.
She said that, you know, some of the stuff Marie drew. You know, I mean,
and
it was signed by, but it's signed by John, but Marie just filled in and did it. But one of my favorite stories she did was that Melvin of the Jungle for the old EC Mad. You know,
I thought that was Wally Wood who did that.
No, that was Marie Severin who drew it. The first one. But that was Marie Severin. But I don't think she was ever a glory hound. I mean, she did fantastic work. Marie Severin, you never stopped being good.
Fantastic colorist.
And, but I always enjoyed your work. I always enjoyed your own. She did that Crazy, that book.
A lot of work for Crazy.
Yeah.
That was not a bad book. They had a lot of good Marvel artists
on
that.
Well, for a while, there was a comic book. Remember they had one where there was a Superman character on the cover with a Fantastic Four fighting it?
Yeah. Yeah, I remember the magazine.
And I had that one. All my friends liked to read that. But, I always liked Marie Severin. But I don't think, again, she was out for glory. And nevertheless, you got it from me.
Definitely. All right, man. Well, I guess that completes episode 99. Upcoming will be the grand 100th issue.
Yeah, we don't know when we'll all get together for that, but we're not doing another show. The four of us are on it. Anyway, I'd like to say thank you to Anthony for doing the interview.
Yep, great interview.
And,
great interviewer, E.
Yeah,
I should say. We tried it. We did our best.
Yeah, he was very good at it. We'll have the documentaries linked on the blog again.
A great documentary.
I can't stress to you, you know, give yourself a watch it because they're really enjoyable.
All right, and then, is that all? Is that all, folks?
That's all I got. In the meantime,
read more comics.
To find Al's other podcasts, Slow Robot A-Go-Go, or his blog, Destination Nightmare, as well as Dallas's webcomic, The Mighty Blue, check out the sidebar at our blog, bunchofdorks.com,
and click on the Cyclops.